Keeping Democracy Alive with Bert Cohen. And our founders knew the importance of education to a republican form of government, to a democracy. You really can't have a democracy if the people are not educated. It's absolutely essential. And with the increased corporatization and concentration of power in America these days, to be citizens consistent with that intent of America's founders, again, education is crucial. Yet, teachers face great pressures to stay away from politically controversial issues in their classrooms. Skittish school boards and administrators can significantly hamper civic education through intense political pressure. Or maybe it doesn't even need to be intense. It's just there. Meanwhile, the truth remains that helping students develop their ability to deliberate political questions en route to becoming knowledgeable and engaged citizens is still an essential component of our very fragile democracy. I'm very pleased to have as guest today Diana Hess, co-author with Paula McAvoy of the new book, The Political Classroom, Evidence and Ethics in Democratic Education. Thanks very much for being with us, Diana.
Good afternoon, Bert.
Well, you are a former high school teacher for over 15 years. Diana Hess has been researching the ways in which teachers engage their students in discussion of highly controversial political and constitutional issues. In her previous book, Controversy in the Classroom, Diana Hess observed that civic education without controversial issues is like a symphony without sound. Boy, I can just picture that. Like a symphony without sound. We gotta have controversial issues discussed in the classroom. What led you to write this new book?
The new book emanated from a study that I started in 2005, and in that study, I was trying to learn more about how students experience and learn in these classrooms where teachers are engaging them in discussions of highly controversial political issues, contemporary issues of the day. So, for example, today, a controversial issue might be what we should do about the Keystone Pipeline, or a controversial issue might be whether or not a local school board should vote to raise property taxes to increase what's offered in the local high school. So these controversial political issues are the issues that animate the public square. And in classrooms where teachers are engaging students in these discussions, I was seeking to learn more about how students experienced them and what they learned from them. And specifically, I was interested in what difference it made long term. So we studied 1,000 students in 35 classes in 20 schools in 3 states. And we started studying them in 2005. We were in their classrooms and we gave them surveys and we did interviews with about 250 students and interviewed the teachers and looked at the materials that were being used in the class. And then we followed the students 2 and 4 years out after high school. So what we wanted to find out in a nutshell is what do students learn from this, what we think is a very powerful approach to civic education.
And we have to have civic education. I was in the, it amazes me, when I was in the state Senate, we were discussing a bill to require civics education in school. And the Republicans, as a bloc, voted against civic education in school. They didn't want to require it. That's really fascinating to me as to where this comes from. And there was a Washington Post just revealed a something about Jeb Bush's Foundation for Excellence in Education. Great title, isn't it? But the foundation was involved in writing state education laws and regulations in ways that aimed at benefiting its corporate funders. How have, for example, for-profit standardized testing companies affected public education and teachers' ability to teach? And what about groups like Jeb Bush's Foundation for Excellence in Education?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Jeb Bush was a big supporter of the Common Core early on. We know that the Common Core, of course, now is very controversial. And it's unclear whether the Common Core is a friend or foe of civic education. On the one hand, the Common Core includes an emphasis on argumentation, on speaking skills,
and
on developing students' critical thinking skills. And all of those things are part and parcel of what needs to happen in high-quality civic education. On the other hand, we know that the Common Core is accompanied by tests of literacy and numeracy, and not tests of civic education or not tests of science or not tests of all the other things that we want students to be exposed to in schools. So there are a number of people in civic education who are really worried that the Common Core is going to narrow the curriculum. And when we narrow the curriculum, what happens is things like civic education tend to get short shrift, especially at the elementary and middle school level. I think it's also the case that the corporatization of education, by definition, doesn't allow for controversial curriculum. And, you know, it just tends to be the kind of thing that is suppressed. And I think what we know is that we want these controversial political issues in the classroom, and they have to be accompanied by high-quality, professionally done curriculum. And in order to do that, we really need to seed lots of nonprofit organizations across the United States to develop these kinds of materials. To be frank, they just aren't coming out of the big corporate entities.
Yeah, what's in it for them after all? You know, and they want to have obedient, non-questioning employees, I guess. Although you would think you need people with skills to serve corporate interests. You need people with thinking skills and critical thinking. Is critical thinking not encouraged now? Is that a concern?
Well, it depends. You know, in many schools, students are learning how to critically think, and especially in high-quality social studies classes.
Right.
You know, the classes that Paul and I studied, we saw a tremendous emphasis on critical thinking. So I think we have lots and lots of teachers across the country who are really doing a superb job already teaching students how to critically think. The challenge is that the more we focus on the assessment of low-level skills and knowledge, the more we direct people's attention to preparing students for those kinds of tests. So it's not that tests per se are wrong.
Right.
Or bad, necessarily. Mm-hmm. But what we want is assessments that capture and evaluate what is really, really important. And I think that's tricky because it's very difficult to develop those assessments, and it's also very expensive. And so one of the things that I worry about is that teachers who are doing a really good job now report to us that they're getting increased pressure to prepare kids for the tests. And that's just a shame.
And you talked about what's important, and I think we need to, as in all education, make sure terms are understood. I don't know how you say what's important. And again, civic education, quite frankly, it wasn't called civics when I was in school back in the 50s and 60s. But what, perhaps you could define what civic education is.
What we mean by civic education is education that's deliberately designed to prepare young people to participate as citizens.
What a concept.
And civic education is something that should happen at all grade levels. I've seen really great examples of civic education in kindergarten. It should certainly happen throughout middle school, throughout high school, and students need a firm foundation when they're in elementary school. And the point of civic education is to make sure students develop the knowledge they need to understand how the political system works, and that they develop the skills they need to be active in that system, and that they develop the disposition to want to do so to begin with. So, for example, we want students to know a lot. It's not that civic education is all about skills and all about action, because we want to make sure that action is informed. So in high-quality civic education, students are learning a lot of content, but they're also learning content that's not just antiquated content, but that's content of the day, and that's where these controversial political issues come in.
Mm.
So the content of civic education that focuses on controversy is to try to make sure that students understand the world that they're living in, and that they understand that these issues are important, and that they learn how to evaluate them, and that they learn how to develop their own points of view on them.
And true, citizenship requires participation. It's not a spectator sport, and action really has to be based on accurate information. And I'm very troubled by the lack of it these days, that people seem to just gut react and not think about, you know, the long term. And there's very little knowledge of the history of where, how we got where we are. That is, you know, as someone said, the past isn't even past. It's still here. And if you just tuned in, our guest today on the on Keeping Democracy Alive is Diana Hess. And the new book is The Political Classroom, Evidence and Ethics in Democratic Education. And I hadn't heard that phrase before, the political classroom. What does that mean? And what are its educational aims? And what kind of training and experience in political discourse in controversial areas should come out of a political classroom?
Well, the aim of the political classroom is to teach students how to deliberate across their political differences. So by political classroom, we mean classrooms in which teachers are engaging students in questions that fundamentally ask, how should we live together? And the we is really important. It's not just about what you want for yourself, but what seems best given that people are differentially affected by policy options. So in a political classroom, students are engaging in discussions with their peers and with their teacher about the political issues of the day. But as you suggest, Bert, they have to be informed by lots of information, and including lots of historical information. You're right that the past isn't past. And so one of the things that we see in classrooms where teachers are really doing a good job with this is that students learn a lot about the history of specific issues. So, for example, it would be very, very difficult to have a high-quality discussion of affirmative action without knowing quite a bit about the legacy of civil rights, the legacy of discrimination, even going back to Jim Crow. So we're not suggesting that people should be talking about issues as if they don't have any historical antecedents.
Well, and I find it's amazing to me how the term racism is being tossed around in the mid-teens of the 21st century. People truly don't seem to understand what the term means. They see people pointing out racism, like happened in Ferguson and is with the case with Eric Garner, and they look at people like the Reverend Al Sharpton who talk about racism. They bring it up, and there are people on the right, frankly, clearly uneducated people, and I hate to say that, but to call that racism is just astounding to me. They don't know what racism really is. And I think, I mean, to understand that, and that's kind of, I can imagine that that there are people who don't want teachers to wade into this area. How do you respond to people who insist that as publicly funded entities, public schools entrusted to educate vulnerable young people, schools must remain non-political? You must have to respond to that powerful dynamic.
Well, the first way I respond to it is to go back to the history of public education in the United States.
Good point.
We developed public schools because we wanted to prepare people to be citizens. That was their primary purpose. And so it's a very American phenomenon to say that schools, in fact, should be political, if by political we mean they should be preparing young people to participate politically. Unfortunately, a lot of people hear the word political and think it means partisan. And then they get nervous. They think, oh my gosh, these public schools that, as you say, are publicly funded are preparing students to believe a particular way. That's exactly the opposite of what we mean in our book by political. What we mean is that students are being prepared to develop their own views about important political issues of the day. But as you suggest, there are some topics that are extremely difficult. You know, we are not doing a very good job talking about issues related to race in the United States. And I don't think we've ever done a very good job talking about those issues. But what we've seen, you know, in the last several months is just how challenging it is to have really high quality discussions of issues that are related to race. It's just extremely difficult. I haven't seen one such discussion in the media in the last couple months. So teachers, as you can imagine, are also confronted with real challenges here, because students do disagree about questions like how much discrimination based on race still goes on in the United States. They do disagree about questions like whether or not it would be a good idea to have video cameras on all police officers. Those are controversial political issues that students disagree about. Now, what we found is that when teachers take on those issues in a responsible way, it's really important. We've seen some very, very good discussions of issues related to race. That being said, we saw some very, very hard discussions of issues related to race. And we do know that there are a number of teachers who are really afraid of these discussions. They do not want them to erupt, and they don't want to have more heat than there is light. Mm-hmm. So I think of all the discussions we watched during this study, and again, you know, we were watching schools in three different states, and some of the schools were in urban areas and some in suburban and some in rural, and some of the schools were racially diverse and some of the schools were not racially diverse, and some were religious schools and some were not religious schools. You know, lots of different kinds of schools. And I would suggest that of all the discussions we heard, the ones related to race were the most challenging for everybody, for students and for the teachers. But I really respected teachers who didn't shy away from those issues. Because I think it's very, very easy for us to say, well, we just want to talk about safe issues.
Yeah.
And you know, that's not how we learn. We need to learn by talking about the issues that are really the most challenging ones.
That's true. And the concept of free speech is not there to protect safe speech. It's there specifically to protect what many people find to be offensive speech. There would be no need for protection of freedom of speech if it were just for safe speech. You must have seen cases where teachers and schools tended to shy away from controversial issues. How did that affect students? Were you able to measure that?
Well, one of the things we saw, because we were in a lot of classes where there were not discussions of these highly controversial political issues. And Paul and I noticed that in those classes, there were a number of things that were quite interesting. One was that those students tended to be less engaged with the news. They were less likely to report that they watched the news. They were less likely to report that they were going to vote in the future. They were less likely to report that they were interested in politics. And they also, and this is just, I think, fascinating, Bert, they were more likely to report that they thought that everybody in the class had the same point of view on controversial political issues.
Yo.
And in the classes, I mean, it makes sense, though, when you think about it, right?
Yeah.
But we often assume that people agree with us until we hear otherwise. And in the classes where teachers were engaging students in these discussions and doing so in a high-quality way, we saw the flip side of all of those things I just mentioned. We saw students who were able to more accurately report how much ideological diversity there was in the class. We saw students who were more likely to say they intended to vote in every election. They expressed more interest in politics. They were following the news more. And they also showed more improvement in their knowledge of general things related to democracy and current events.
Yeah, that can't be anything but a good thing. I always find, I mean, I certainly lean to the left politically, but I respect very much people who are on the right, who are politically active. That's what's intended by being citizenship. The people who don't participate, who say, oh, I have nothing to do with politics, that I find very frustrating, because that's just so antithetical to the intention of America's founders, that, you know, be it right, be it left, participate. Get involved, learn about, make good discussions, make your case. That's extremely important. And obviously, educators have a huge part to play in that. And Diana Hess, you mentioned, you know, watching the news. I can just imagine young people watching the news and seeing members of Congress in particular behave badly, you know, and that, you know, it tends to be partisan discussion is oftentimes appears to be uncivil. And frankly, as parents and teachers, we want our kids to be civil. You know, I wonder if it's that example of seeing this, you know, ugly partisanship makes it more difficult for educators to structure courses that students really do civilly encounter and engage with people who have different opinions from themselves. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Well, you're absolutely right, Bert. I mean, we don't have a lot of models in the world outside of school of high-quality civil public discourse across ideological difference.
Yeah, it does tend
to be United
uncivil.
States is more politically polarized than we've been since the 1920s. And I think that for a whole variety of reasons that people are being rewarded for engaging in behavior that really is lacking in civility.
Yes.
Teachers that we worked with did not want anything to do with these highly uncivil conversations. They saw the world outside of school as something that they were teaching in opposition to. In other words, they didn't want their students to look like screaming talking heads on the news at all.
Yeah.
And the teachers who are good at this, they know how to establish strong norms for civility, because you're right, Bert. Parents want their young children to learn how to talk with one another civically. And civilly.
Yes.
And we want that, you know, that's important not just in terms of political engagement. It's important in every aspect of our lives. You know, we need to be able to talk with people in the workplace when we disagree with them, even if what we're disagreeing with them is some kind of, you know, group development project related to work and has nothing to do with politics. So we need to develop those skills in young people, and the teachers were really quite good at it. And, you know, the kind of personal insults that we often see, you know, we've even seen them, you know, personal insults on the floor of the House and the Senate.
Oh, yeah.
Those are not allowed in these classrooms.
Oh, good. Yeah. The adults are setting bad examples, the ones down in Washington. I guess I've heard that cockroaches are more highly thought of in general than members of Congress. Really. We are talking on Keeping Democracy Alive with Bert Cohen. Our guest today is Diana Hess, a co-author with Paula McAvoy of The Political Classroom, Evidence and Ethics in Democratic Education. And in your book, you chose to study unusual social studies classrooms. Why did you choose them, and how did they differ from typical high school civics, government, and political science and history classes?
Well, we began seeking unusual classes because we knew from prior research that this particular approach to civic education, that is the inclusion of highly controversial political issues in the curriculum, was an approach that we thought was making a big difference in terms of civic payoff. And so we wanted to understand it better. And we especially, Bert, wanted to understand it better in terms of what happens after students leave high school. So we worked with two democratic education organizations. One is called the Choices for the 21st Century Project at Brown University, and the other is the Constitutional Rights Foundation that's located here in Chicago, where I currently live. And those organizations run a lot of programs for teachers to teach them how to engage in these kinds of discussions with their students. And so we sought from those organizations names of teachers who they thought were good at doing this. And we located those teachers initially in two states, Illinois and Indiana, which at the time in 2005 were very different politically. Indiana at the time was a pretty red state.
Oh, yeah.
Illinois at the time was a pretty blue state.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the next year of the study, we expanded to Wisconsin, which at the time was a pretty mixed or purple state.
Mm.
And then we sought out teachers who were doing this kind of work, but they were using more homegrown curriculum that they had developed. And we wanted these unusual examples because we wanted to see what happened in classes where students were learning how to do this. But we also had more typical examples in those schools. And what we were seeking to do was to compare and contrast. You know, what does it look like to be in a government class where the teacher lectures all the time,
right,
compared to a government class where students are expected to do the intellectual work?
So what did you find from that? I mean, in those cases where the teachers just lectured, what became of them?
Well, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this is that there are a lot of teachers who are really great lecturers. So I remember being in some of these classes absolutely fascinated by some of these lectures.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, this is really, really interesting. And the students often thought it was interesting as well. So I don't want to demonize lecturing.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think in lots of good classes, teachers do lecture. However, if lecturing is the bread and butter of the pedagogy, in other words, if that's what teachers are doing day in and day out, we know that that's not going to work very well. It's not hard enough, ironically. You know, we often think that lecturing and having students listen and take notes and memorize information, that's hard. Actually, the problem with that is it's too easy.
True.
That it's much more difficult to have students be the worker bees in the classroom. And so one of the questions that I often ask when I go into classes is, what is the nature of the intellectual work happening in this classroom, and who's doing it?
Mm-hmm.
And I want the answer to be high and the students. And therefore, there can't be lecturing day in and day out because it's not requiring students to do the kind of work we want them to do. And so what we found in these all-lecture classrooms is we just weren't getting the same kinds of civic outcomes that we were getting in these other classes. And you know what was interesting, Bert? When we interviewed these students 2 and 4 years out after high school, their memory of these very engaging civic classes where they had the discussions of controversial political issues were crystal clear. It was just uncanny to me how students could say, well, I remember that discussion we had about same-sex marriage, or I remember that discussion we had about the Iraq War, and I remember what I thought about it, and I actually changed my mind, or I remember that we had a lot of disagreement in the class. And in the lecture classes, we didn't hear those kinds of crystal clear memories. We heard things more like, well, I remember that teacher was really smart. One kid said, well, I remember he wore really funny sweaters every day.
Interesting. And teachers certainly, you know, are expected to have significant knowledge, and lecture is one way of conveying that knowledge. And I imagine it can still greatly stimulate the kids' thinking and critical thinking. But if they don't have a channel by which to, you know, communicate their concerns and their questions and their disagreements, that doesn't exactly bridge the gap between participating and not participating. And you've seen students for whom political conversation is second nature. And that must be exciting to see. And can it be quantitatively related to classes where, you know, there has been real civic education and real enabling disagreements civilly?
Absolutely. You know, students can learn how to participate in discussions. You know, sometimes people say, well, you're either born a talker or you're not. And I've even heard parents say this, like, well, my child just doesn't like to talk in class.
Oh my.
And my response is, well, what would you do if your child said, I just don't like to do math? Would you say, oh, that's okay, you don't like to do math? Well, that would be, you know, absurd. And similarly, we need to make sure that all young people learn how to participate verbally. And we have good, solid evidence from research that that can be taught, just like writing can be taught and just like math can be taught. But it has to be taught very explicitly. It has to be something where students are expected to talk and where they're getting high-quality feedback on how they're doing. It can't be a discussion in which the kids who are already really verbally proficient just get an opportunity to practice day in and day out.
Right.
So in these discussions that were really high quality, what we saw was teachers going to great lengths to make sure that all students were participating. It wasn't the kind of thing that we might remember from high school or from college, where you just had, you know, two or three students who were the ones always with their hands up, the ones always participating. In fact, the teachers in our study who were really good at this saw over-participation as much of a problem as under-participation.
Well, that ain't bad. I mean, that's a good problem to have. Definitely. And I'm curious about your study. This was a fairly extensive study. Studies are expensive. I wonder what support you have had so far in doing these studies. Are there foundations that help you out? What about the NEA, for example?
Well, we were really lucky to be funded by a number of nonpartisan foundations that were interested in the research questions that we were exploring. So, for example, we were funded by the McCormick Foundation here in Chicago that has a big program in civic education. We were funded by the Carnegie Corporation of New York that was doing a lot of funding for civic education. We had some funding from my university, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, through their graduate research competition. We had funding from the Spencer Foundation, which is the foundation where I'm currently working. As a matter of fact, I got to know the Spencer Foundation through the way in which they had supported this research. So we had lots of different grants from lots of different foundations. We did not have any government money whatsoever for this study. You know, there's a lot of government money to fund research related to math and science and literacy and STEM, but there is very little government money to fund research in civic education. So the people who do this kind of research, and there are a number of us across the country, we always need to find private sources of funding.
Boy, and you would think if the people in government were being true to the intent of the founders, they would fund that. But as we know, things have come a long way since then. And I wonder, you know, there are towns that are fairly, and regions, you know, that are fairly politically and culturally homogeneous. That must present some unique challenges. What can teachers do specifically to combat students' lack of exposure to conflicting opinions? I mean, you know, you got the liberal Northeast and the right-wing South generally, and, you know, different neighborhoods like that. And I imagine parents really like to keep local values in charge of how their students are being educated. That must be some interesting challenges.
Absolutely, and that was one of the major findings of the study. So we encountered classrooms in which the majority of students came into the class having substantial agreement with one another politically.
Sure.
And though we call those classrooms like-minded classes, and those classes were like-minded both on the right and the left.
Sure.
So we had very conservative classes, and we had some very progressive classes. And we also had a lot of classes where there was a really good mix. We called those purple classes, just like we call, you know, purple states, states where there's a pretty even split between Republicans and Democrats.
Right.
Well, what we found was that in these mixed classes, these purple classes, teachers really had a lot of deliberative assets from which to work because they had a lot of authentic existing difference in the class, which was really great. Oftentimes, the teachers in those classes would have to report really working hard on civility norms because they didn't want, you know, discussions to be too explosive.
Yeah.
But those classes were really great places for students to learn how to listen to people who did not have the same views as they did. And that was, you know, just incredibly important because, Bert, what we know is that in the world outside of school, very few of us encounter views that are different than our own. You know, we've so segmented where we get information now. You know, people watch Fox News or they watch MSNBC.
Right.
Or they listen to a particular radio station or they go to particular websites or particular blogs. That in many cases, we're kind of marinating in an ideological stew of sameness.
Mm.
And that is not a good thing. It's not a good thing for democracy. It's one of the major things that I'm worried about. So in these purple classes where there were lots of kids from across the ideological spectrum, it was really wonderful because kids were getting something that most of us don't get. On the other hand, as you suggest, there were classes that were much more ideologically homogenous. And in those classes, the teachers had to do a lot of work to make sure that students had to encounter multiple and competing views. So we came away with two big findings in those classes.
Mm-hmm.
One was that even in classes that looked to be ideologically very similar, there always was more difference than you would think.
Mm.
So you can scratch under the surface, and there's always going to be some disagreement. It's not like there's, you know, a completely monolithic political viewpoint. And one of the things that we learned just as a matter of research is that asking young people who they would support if they were able to vote in a presidential election was not a very good predictor of their political views. Because we had some classrooms in which all the students said that they would have voted for the candidate from one party, and yet they still did disagree on some issues. So the first thing we learned was don't assume that everyone agrees just because it looks like there's a lot of ideological sameness. But we did also learn that in those classes where there still was substantial agreement, that it was really important for teachers to artificially insert multiple and competing views. So how did they do that?
Hmm.
Well, they did that by bringing in materials, often from these high-quality democratic education organizations, where kids had to be exposed to different points of view. In some cases, they brought in guest speakers. So we were in one remarkable classroom, Mr. Kushner's classroom. We have a whole chapter about him in the book. And he had a classroom of students who, to a person, believed that abortion should be legal. And he brought in a speaker who believed the opposite and who was part of a major political movement supporting the opposite point of view. And initially when we interviewed the kids, they were pretty mad about that. And then after a while, they started thinking, oh, wait a minute, that was really a good thing. And then when we interviewed them 2 and 4 years after high school, we heard them talk about this. It was like, yeah, that was great. Because Mr. Kushner made sure that we didn't demonize difference, that we really needed to understand what people believed who believed differently than we did. And we just had enormous respect for him because he was doing this in a climate where a lot of other teachers, to be frank, were not doing it. They were not exposing their kids to multiple and competing views. We asked one student in this school, well, is Mr. Kushner different in your other classes? Are you hearing these competing points of view? And this student said, look, in this school, we've seen every Michael Moore film twice.
Yeah, it's important to look at the other side. And as you're talking, I feel really blessed to have served many years in the New Hampshire State Senate, where there were a lot of Republicans. I obviously was not. But you got to work with them. You got to listen to them and be able to speak to their arguments and to find common ground sometimes. And it's, you can't get anything done if you're not civil. That was a unique situation. Not many people get to serve in a legislative capacity, but to be able to do that, I mean, I'm really glad that I learned so much, that respect other people and be able to work with them. Because, you know, obviously as adults, we tend to hang out with people who are like us, you know, and stay away from others. But what does that get us? And again, to see, you know, a whole bunch of Michael Moore films, that's not doing the kids a service. I mean, even though I obviously agree with a lot of what he says, that's really not doing the kids a service. And, you know, I wonder again about neighborhoods. You know, in the 70s, forced busing was strongly resisted by parents who insisted their kids go to local neighborhood schools, which I can understand. I wonder, are there benefits of living and going to school with people who have very similar values and agree with you on most things? There must be some benefits of that, but obviously there are some deficits that you're only getting one side. You know, I can imagine oftentimes, I mean, forced busing was pretty, you know, jarring to actually bus the kids physically from one place to another. But to kind of force a situation where you get other values, I would think that would be important in schools. And I wonder if you could just speak to that.
Well, one of the things that's very interesting from our study, and other researchers have found this as well, is that there actually are some benefits of growing up in a like-minded community. One of the things we know is that people who are growing up in a like-minded area are more likely to be ideologically coherent and intensely partisan. And people who are intensely partisan are more likely to participate politically.
Yes.
So we have this real challenge in contemporary America. And the challenge goes like this. Most of the people who participate politically are intensely partisan. And yet, yes, hyper-partisanship and hyper-polarization prevents us from solving the problems that are so important that we solve. So in some ways, we're doing ourselves in by who participates politically. What we want is political participation regardless of how intensely partisan you are. So what we found in our study is that these young people who are growing up in these like-minded communities were much more likely to participate politically after they left high school. You know, it clearly was a predictor of political participation. And, you know, that's not a surprise to us, but we're concerned about it. And so what we see is that schools have to take this on as a real problem, that if what we're doing in school is just feeding into political polarization, that's not a good thing. On the other hand, there's nothing wrong with being partisan, right? There's nothing, we want people to have perspectives and have a point of view. What's wrong is that if you're so partisan that you demonize difference.
Right.
That's wrong. And what we have now is increasing evidence from lots and lots of research that people are more likely to demonize the other side than they would have been 10 or 20 years ago. One recent study showed that a majority of Republicans and almost a majority of Americans believe that the other party is literally dangerous for the future of the United States. That's simply a disaster for democracy. And so what we need to do in schools is recognize that we want kids to develop their political views, because if they develop their political views, they're more likely to participate, and they're more likely to be informed participants. But we don't want at the same time to have kids develop political views that prevent them from being able to hear political views that are different from they are.
Yeah.
And you mentioned busing, Bert. You know, one of the things that I'm really worried about is that schools are not just more ideologically homogenous than they were in the past, but they're more racially and ethnically homogenous, and more homogenous by social class. We're not doing a very good job living up to the promise of integration. And it's really a problem, because if you've got students who are being educated with other students who are very similar to them, they're not being prepared to live in a nation where we've got lots of people who are very different. And I was most intrigued by the schools in the study that had a lot of racial and ethnic and social class diversity. And some schools, quite frankly, took advantage of that, and some schools didn't. So some schools set up tracking systems where, you know, kids were in honors classes or remedial classes. And those tracking systems, unfortunately, tracked kids by race and by social class. And other schools refused to do that. We had one remarkable school, Adams High. We've got a whole chapter about Adams High in the book, that absolutely refused to track the required senior government class, which meant that all the kids in the school were in those classes together. There were kids who were very wealthy and kids who were not. There were kids who were white. There were kids who were recent immigrants. There were kids who were African-American and kids who were Latino. It really looked like America. And those teachers believed that their mission, what they needed to do their job, was to teach those students how to deal with one another in really productive ways. And even when they were discussing hotly controversial issues like affirmative action or immigration policy, it was really quite remarkable. And I think it's really a shame that we've created a lot of schools and classes purposely, I would argue, to make sure that they don't represent the diversity that makes up for the richness and, in many ways, the best strength of America.
Boy, that whole tracking thing, as you talk about, that was discussed about Adams High School, that's very interesting stuff. And it, you know, makes me think a little bit about in England. I don't know if it's still the case, but it used to be the case that early on, it was determined if you were on a, you know, working class track or if you would go on to higher education. And American education was quite different from that. And I, you know, this tracking thing, it sounds somewhat similar. How important is it to resist tracking along these things?
Well, I think it's very important to resist tracking.
Yeah.
You know, I think on the one hand, we want to make sure that all students get their needs met. So it's not like there's never a good reason to have students in separate classes. You know, if a student is ready to learn trigonometry, they shouldn't be in the algebra class. You know, on the other hand, we want to make sure that when we do create those separate classes, that they don't separate people based on race or social class or ethnicity. So we really have to be attentive to it. And for the most part, I think there are lots of classes that just shouldn't be tracked. I would argue, and I fight with people about this all the time, that civic education classes in particular should not be tracked. There shouldn't be an honors citizenship or remedial citizenship class. That's just on its face wrong.
That sounds, frankly, really dangerous, you know, to have it separated so much. If you just tuned into Keeping Democracy Alive with Bert Cohen, our guest today is Diana Hess. The book is that she co-wrote with Paula McAvoy. The book is The Political Classroom, Evidence and Ethics in Democratic Education. And in this book, you describe a provocative lesson in Mrs. Potter's geography classroom. What did she do, and what does this lesson show about the ethics of including politics in the curriculum?
Well, Miss Potter was teaching in a Catholic school that had a very pronounced social justice mission. It was a really interesting school. It was an all-girls school in a city, and it was incredibly diverse. And a fascinating place. I just loved spending time there. And this teacher, Miss Potter, was very interested in making sure that students understood the inequalities that existed in the world. So she created a lesson where students would be assigned a nation, and they would get wealth based on how much wealth that nation had. And it was a simulation that actually is not all that unusual. I've seen things like this in lots of other classes. But in that simulation, there were a number of students who interpreted it as being very left-wing. And, you know, one student even shouted out, "Die Bush," during the simulation. And we were struck by that. We were really interested in whether or not that lesson was a high-quality lesson that really reflected these economic differences in nations across the world, or whether or not that lesson really had an implicit bias that was inappropriate. So we wrote a case study of that lesson, and what's interesting is when teachers read it and we talk to them about it, it really sparks a lot of disagreement. And the reason it sparks a lot of disagreement is because there's a lot of disagreement about how something should be determined legitimately controversial or not. So one of the things we learned in the study is that teachers encounter these ethical dilemmas. And my co-author, Paula McAvoy, is a very fine philosopher. And one of the reasons that I so liked writing this book with her is that she kept us focused on these philosophical questions. So one philosophical question is, well, what criteria should we use to determine whether something is legitimately controversial?
Right.
And another one was, should we avoid issues that are particularly sensitive to some students? And a third very common one is, should teachers withhold or share their own political views? So throughout the book, we've got these case studies that demonstrate how teachers wrestle with these issues. And we suggest that for all of these issues, there's not a right or wrong answer in most cases. But instead, these are matters where teachers have to exercise really good professional judgment. And we try to explain examples of what that would look like in practice.
That's got to be somewhat challenging sometimes. I wonder about, you know, there's the old Socratic method. He knew a lot way back then. And there's, you know, playing devil's advocate. I can imagine that can be an important way of teaching, yes?
Yes, we saw a lot of devil's advocacy. So we saw teachers who would use devil's advocacy as a way of inserting different political views, especially in these like-minded classes we were talking about before. But we also saw teachers using devil's advocacy when they thought that there was some perspective that just wasn't getting enough weight, or if there was a student in the class who the teacher thought deserved more support. So, you know, it's really hard if you're a student in a class where you're the only one who believes a certain way.
Yeah.
And oftentimes we would see teachers use devil's advocacy on the side of that student to make sure that that student's perspective was not being ignored.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, we had this really interesting finding related to devil's advocacy, which is that students who had recently arrived in the United States and were you know, learning English were often not familiar with what the expression meant.
Uh-huh.
And so the teacher would say, well, just to play devil's advocate. And the students thought, oh, my God, the teacher is the devil. Or the students thought, you know, that the teacher was actually exerting his or her own views. And so one of the things that we have done with this is to encourage teachers to make sure that they don't assume that students know what the expression devil's advocate means.
True. That's important, and looking at, you know, the cultural backgrounds of their classes. And I wonder, you know, are there some issues that really are just too controversial? I mean, there are some teachers and parents, for sure, who would argue that evolution is not settled fact and is just too controversial to talk about. There's climate change, marriage equality, the subject of Israel-Palestine. Did you figure out, you know, is there some criteria for determining if a topic is too controversial or is ripe for discussion and debate? It's got to put teachers in a tough position sometimes, especially given a community where they are.
Absolutely. You know, when teachers reported that parents were upset with them, it was often because of the issue that was being discussed.
Sure.
That either the teachers were inserting an issue into the curriculum that teachers thought didn't deserve to be in the curriculum at all, or the teachers were presenting it as a matter of controversy when it shouldn't be, or vice versa, presenting it as a settled question when the teachers wanted it to be controversial. So this was a really challenging pedagogical stew to kind of work through.
Sure.
So the way that Paul and I went at this was we first make a distinction in the book between a policy issue and an empirical issue. So an empirical issue is a question for which there either is or could be an answer. So,
yes.
For example, the question of whether climate change is occurring is an empirical question,
yes,
right?
Yes, it
that
can be determined.
Answered
yes.
by science.
Yes.
And we argue in the book that it has been answered by science.
Yes.
That the question of whether or not climate change is occurring is a settled question among scientists who study climate change. And so we think that that should be taught as a settled issue in the classroom, that science classes, for example, should not be teaching the question of whether climate change is occurring as an open, or by that we mean controversial, question.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, there are policy questions, and policy questions are questions for which there never will be a settled empirical answer, because there's lots of things that we need to weigh in on that go beyond empiricism. So what to do about climate change? That's a policy question.
Hmm.
And those questions are still live and ripe and open. And we argue that those should be treated as controversial issues.
Okay.
Now, you mentioned evolution, Bert, which is another, you know, really hot-button issue. Well, evolution, Paul and I argue, is a settled scientific question.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah, it just...
And we have a lot of, you know, support from this from people who are specialists in science education.
Oh,
for
sure.
example, the Generation Next Science Standards that were just developed in the last couple of years by the best science educators and best science researchers in the country, they argue that in the U.S. curriculum, in science classes, both climate change and evolution should be taught as scientifically settled empirical questions. Now, that doesn't mean that we know everything there is to know about them, and it doesn't mean that they won't later open up again. You know, sometimes we learn things that
right.
cause us to unsettle
think.
Something that was
settled. Yeah, true. But for now, it's settled. But then again, climate change can lead to a discussion, especially in places like West Virginia, where there's coal mining, and some of their parents may depend on, you know, continuing to have their jobs mining coal. You know, how it's taught there and what to do about it, I would think that would be a, you know, a controversial and appropriate issue for discussion. But what about, there are those non-settled issues like abortion and marriage equality and the issue of Israel and Palestine. Would you
right.
get suggestions on those? Should they be?
Well, I mean, you've named three issues that we know a lot about, because we've learned a lot about how teachers approach those issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all three of those issues we would consider open policy questions.
Yes.
In other words, there's still live controversy,
yes.
even though people, you know, have perspectives on those, including teachers have perspectives on those. But we saw those issues being talked about in these classrooms as open controversies. And I think they're all very difficult, but not impossible. We saw great discussions of same-sex marriage. We saw very high-quality discussions of abortion. In this study, we didn't see any discussions of Israel and Palestine, but in other studies I've done, I've seen discussions of that. So I think that all of those can be talked about, but, you know, you have to be very careful. You have to make sure that students are getting well prepared for those discussions. I wouldn't start a class with those discussions. You know, I would want to make sure that students have developed good norms of civility.
Good point.
For sure.
Yeah.
And I'd also want to make sure that parents and administrators and the general public, for that matter, understand that the purpose of the discussion is not to cause students to adopt a particular point of view. And I think that that is the most important thing. And, you know, that can be very, very difficult. You know, imagine if you're a teacher with a very strong perspective on one of those issues. You know, your responsibility, I would argue, is to make sure that students don't think that your answer needs to be their answer.
And the idea of sameness, you know, it does seem that there is pressure to have, you know, the same outcome on tests, you know, a solid outcome. But it sounds like that, you know, sameness is at distance, it's disagreeing with the idea of citizenship and participating in democracy. The book is called The Political Classroom, Evidence and Ethics in Democratic Education. Is there, perhaps, people, of course, can buy the book. Diana Hess has been our guest, co-author with Paula McAvoy. Again, The Political Classroom, Evidence and Ethics in Democratic Education. I wonder if there are any websites to which you can point listeners.
Well, our publisher, Routledge, has a website, and we're in the process of developing a website. So stay tuned. That should be up.
All right.
Pretty soon. We're actually really having fun developing the website. One of the things we're going to do with it is put lesson plans on the website, because we've got a lot of teachers who are using the textbook in university classrooms that are preparing people to be civic education teachers. Uh-huh. And so those professors are now starting to share some of their lesson plans with us. So we're going to make sure that this website is not just a promotional website, but it's one that people can learn from.
And
so we're really having fun developing it.
And it'll be through Routledge?
The Routledge website's already up.
Oh, okay.
That's a separate website. So, you know, hopefully our website will be up in I would say, about a month, and it's just going to be thepoliticalclassroom.com.
Sounds great. Thank you so much. This has been, dare I say, very educational.
Well, thanks, Bert. I really enjoyed your question.
Well, thanks for your work, and let's keep democracy alive, shall we? Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Young love, teacher's pet. Cheeks flushed, apple red. Ringing you every day. Begging for a word of praise. I put aside my foolish game. I run and hide and call her names. School's out, bells will ring. Now's the time to teach me everything. Teacher, teacher, teach me love. I can't learn fast enough. Teacher, teacher, teach me more. I got to learn to love for sure. Lesson one just begun. Growing up ain't much fun. Out of school, out of love, and out of rules. No one there can tell me how. A different world, teacher, teach me now. Teacher, teacher, teach me love. I can't learn it fast enough. Teacher, teacher, teach me more. I got to learn to love for sure. Lesson two, nothing new. I can't love, just passing through.